Rick is a long-term member of Socialist Alternative. He's an expert on the Labor Party, co-author of this great book on Labor's conflict, which is a must-read for anyone who's interested in kind of pursuing the question of the Labor Party after this session. He's also a scholar and a renowned expert on the Polish Marxist Henryk Grossman. And so there's a lot going on in that brain. There's a lot of history and expertise, and it's a privilege to have him as a member of Socialist Alternative and bringing some of that expertise to the question of the Labour government, the likely future Labour government, and its prospects in Australia today. There's heaps of time for discussion, questions, comments, avid defences of the Labour Party, if there's anyone here who wants to go down that path. After his tour. So if there's stuff that you want to say, maybe make a note of it or file it away or whatever. And after Rick's done his full intro, then we'll open it up to people to raise whatever they want to raise. One final plug, sorry, Rick, is just for the Marxist Left Review, which is Socialist Alternative's more theoretical journal. We've got in this issue alone, there's articles on Labour, Greens and the independents in government, the rise and fall of the ALP left, and a series of other questions which relate to this talk and other important questions for leftists in Australia. We have made a really serious attempt with this journal to develop a kind of more of a theoretical canon about Australian politics, which not really anyone else in the world is interested in writing about and doing the kind of research that some of the featured authors have been doing for that journal. And so take a look at that, take a look at this issue specifically. There's a whole series of other issues and the current one available in the bookshop. The bookshop will close at the end of lunch today, so if you haven't checked that out yet, definitely go and do so. But that's more than enough of an introduction, so please make room. Roll.
Well, I was going to start with Leon Russellson's Battle Hymn of the New Socialist Party, which was an updated version of the Red Flag written for the British Labour Party, dispensing with the irrelevant material about the working class and so on. But I've got an appalling singing voice, and given the technical difficulties, I'm not going to sing it. Well, barring stunning incompetence and fuck-ups by the Labour Party, which cannot be ruled out, we are likely to have a Labour government sometime after the 18th of May. Now, the Labour Party is led by a guy who's best known for his dynamic impersonations of a block of radiata pine, and who is also known for his impeccable, dramatic timing. Now, his character actually accurately expresses the radicalism and appeal, I think, of Labor's policies. And what I want to do is go fairly briefly through the Labor Party's, some of the Labor Party's policies for this election, and then to talk about the nature of the Labor Party, or what I call its material constitution, what the guts of the Labor Party is, and then to do a bit of a dash through some of the Labor Party's history, which is covered in much more detail in this, the first comprehensive Marxist history of the Labor Party by Tom Bramble and myself. Okay, well, the core of states, including capitalist states like Australia, is the function of repression. That's really what the guts is. How does the Labor Party stand there? In two categories, repression at home and repression abroad. What in particular is the difference between the Labor Party's policies on domestic oppression and oppression abroad? Well, this is dealt with very quickly indeed. Fuck all. Labor has gone along with every conservative restriction of civil liberties and the expansion of the powers of what we Marxists are prone to call the repressive apparatus of the state. What about abroad? What about in foreign policy? Well, there are differences in rhetoric, but in terms of actual practice and commitments, military and alliance commitments, there is no difference, or minuscule difference as well. Most importantly, Labor is as committed to the alliance with the United States as the Conservatives are, and committed militarily to that alliance as the Conservatives are. Now, there's a bit more appealing stuff in terms of Labor's policies when we come to a series of other questions, including questions that have to do with class. Labor has actually said that the living wage is to be decided by the Fair Work Commission. A living wage, that sounds terrific. Fair Work Commission? The Fair Work Commission has very recently been stacked with Liberal appointees, friends in the legal profession appointed to Fair Work Australia. So the idea that there is going to be the establishment of a real living wage by Fair Work Australia requires a bit of a stretch of the imagination. Labor has committed to reinstating penalty rates in retail, hospitality and fast food, and that will make a difference for significant numbers of casual and part-time workers. I want to read you something else. And here the illiteracy is not entirely my own or me stumbling over the words. Labor will provide a balanced and effective compliance regime which will provide procedural and substantive fairness to all parties in the construction industry. Labor will abolish the Australian Building and Construction Commission and repeal the Building and Construction Industry Improving Productivity Act, including the Code for the Tendering and Performance of Building Work 2016, and abolish the Australian Building and Construction Commission. Abolishing the ABCC is there twice because they're keen to get funding from the CFMMEU. However, the same section of Labor's platform, from which I am quoting, says, Labor will ensure that an independent umpire has a responsibility and necessary powers to ensure that unions can be effective in fulfilling their role as a legitimate representatives of working people. In other words, it's not union members who will decide. It's somebody else. It's the independent umpire which will decide, stacked with conservatives. And you know, maybe there'll be a bit of counter-stacking, so there'll be a bunch of right-wing Labor Party people on the Fair Work Commission as well. There's also a policy of same job, same pay, which is pretty good, reunifying public service pay and conditions, which is a payoff for the support that the CPSU has provided for the Labor Party, and which is the CPSU's only approach to defending its members, not having led a serious struggle for many years, but focusing on getting Labor re-elected. The gender pay gap is going to be targeted. Terrific. How is that going to happen? Companies are going to have to publicise the pay gap in their organisations. Powerful stuff. Labor will improve access to collective bargaining, including where appropriate, through multi-employer collective bargaining. In other words, a move to some extent away from enterprise bargaining, which some of you may remember was introduced by the Hawke-Keating government. There's one small thing that's missing, small but fairly important to the Australian working class. That's the right to strike. Labor is not going to establish the right of workers to go on strike when they need to go on strike. not just when it's convenient for the bargaining process, the legal bargaining process. Legalise the right to strike when somebody is killed on the job. It's illegal to go on strike now if one of your workmates is killed on the job to protest against lack of safety at work. Medicare. But there are some good bits and pieces, although in order to overcome the so-called Medi-scare of the last election, the Morrison government has also decided to try and match Labor on the question of Medicare. And, you know, you might think matching Labor, Labor's setting the pace. No, it's not Labor setting the pace. It's us setting the pace. It's the importance of access to decent health care that is so important to the mass of working people that both the Labor Party and the Conservatives as well have to pay some attention to it. But it's important that the freeze on some Medicare payments is going to be lifted, but it's worthwhile noting who implemented the freeze in the first place. It was a guy called Wayne Swan, who was the Treasurer. I think he was the Treasurer under all three of Rudd, Gillard, Rudd. What's missing from that policy is universal free healthcare. That doesn't exist in Australia, and Labor is not proposing that it should exist, only that Medicare should be a bit better funded. And part of a universal healthcare system, of course, would include the abolition of private health insurance and the nationalisation of private hospitals, which largely subsist, the bigger ones, subsist on government money. What about Social Security? Well, there's a promise to review Newstart. What a big deal. Review Newstart. Not establish a standard for Newstart, but to review Newstart. The Conservatives, it has to be conceded, don't even talk about reviewing Newstart. There will be no reversal of that hit feminist hero Julia Gillard's curtailment of access to supporting parents' benefit when Labor comes back, into office. There will be no end to work for the dole, despite the fact that there are more unemployed people than there are job vacancies, and that has been the case for a very long time. What's missing here? Well, guaranteed livable payments, including universal pensions and the abolition of concessions to private superannuation, which was introduced under Paul Keating's government, private superannuation, which was introduced not to ensure that people had decent standards of living in their retirement, but to take the pressure off the pension. These days, however, tax concessions for superannuation are a bigger notional outlay than the outlays on pension payments. What about tax? Well, positive things there, removing negative gearing and cash refunds for franking credits, both of which were essentially giveaways to the capitalist class and some middle layers in society. What's not there is a restitution of a radically progressive income tax, which actually Australia had up until the 1980s. The highest tax rate in Australia has been 80%. It's now down to what, 32 or 45? So there's no idea of if you're rich, then you should make a proportionally greater contribution to the society's well-being. And there's no idea of getting rid of the GST, which is a consumption tax, which falls disproportionately on people with lower incomes. What about issues of oppression? Well, Labor's going to maintain the Northern Territory intervention. It hasn't talked about getting rid of the cashless debit card. In terms of Aboriginal people, a couple of quotes again from the platform. community control and direct involvement of First Nations peoples in the planning and delivery of programs and services is important. Well, that's absolutely true. Labor will invest in high-performance, community-controlled Indigenous organisations to deliver the services First Nations people want and need. That's pretty good. But, this is in the same document, Labor supports mainstream funding and service delivery with a strong focus on positive outcomes for First Nations people. The idea of Indigenous-controlled services and mainstreaming the provision of services are directly contradictory. What's missing, of course, is an unambiguous commitment to Aboriginal self-determination, including guaranteed funding for Aboriginal-controlled organisations. On xenophobic racism, as opposed to racism towards Australia's Indigenous people, Labor will work towards a bipartisan approach to dealing with refugees. In other words, they will shift their position if the coalition does. What that means is a continuation of mandatory detention of asylum seekers, offshore processing of asylum seekers, and people arriving on boats in Australia unable to settle in this country. What's missing is an unambiguous commitment to refugee rights. The environment. Well, look, here it's, you know, it's a lay down, Mazir. Labor is going to ban plastic bags. Okay, the environment is going to be in safe hands. There will be zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. By which time we'll all be fried. And that is to be achieved by that tried and tested mechanism of a cap and trade mechanisms. In other words, relying on markets. Now, that has been most systematically tried in the European Union, and it has been a staggering failure. Since the conference began, I heard on the radio that Labor's path to more rapid greenhouse gas emissions will not be by reducing greenhouse gas emissions in Australia primarily, but by buying offsets from overseas. Labor accordingly will allow the Adani mine will go ahead as far as Labor is concerned, and Labor will accordingly allow the mining and export of uranium only under the most stringent of circumstances. So what's missing here? Public investment in renewable, low-carbon energy generation to rapidly replace coal and gas. Overall, there are differences between Labor and the coalition, but those differences are tiny. You need a magnifying glass and a micrometer in a lot of cases to work out what those differences are. Well, why are the differences so minuscule? The reason has to do with the nature of the party, and the nature of the party since, at the latest, the late 1890s, like roughly 130 years ago. The Labor Party is a capitalist workers' party. That's a phrase that I've taken from an obscure Russian theorist called Lenin. The Labor Party has an organic connection with the working class and is, at the same time that it has intimate connections with the working class, committed to managing Australian capitalism through the mechanisms of the Australian capitalist state. That makes it somewhat different from the Liberals and the US Democrats, which do not have the same connections with the working class. What are those connections? Well, membership, a bit. I'll come back to these again in terms of changes. Voters, rather more, even when a majority of the working class hasn't voted for the Labor Party, working class voters have consistently been a much larger proportion of the vote for the Labor Party than for the Conservative Party, or for that matter, the Greens. Thirdly, the weight of trade union officials inside the Labor Party. Union affiliation establishes an indirect relationship between the working class and the Labor Party because it occurs through full-time union officials. Although trade unions are absolutely crucial, fundamental self-defence organisations for workers, the full-time leaders of trade unions, by definition, by the nature of their jobs, are not workers. They don't work for a boss. They are a special layer in society whose role is to wholesale that peculiar commodity, a crucial commodity for capital, that is your and my ability to work. Their job is to negotiate the terms of the sale of labour power. And that involves certainly maintaining some credibility in the eyes of rank and file members of the trade union, because trade union officials by and large want to maintain their jobs and get re-elected, and therefore members can have an effect on their union leaders, can exercise pressure on them. But it also entails maintaining credibility in the eyes of employers and the state as well. And when the working class is not moving in an impressive way, when workers are not confident about their own power, despite the tremendous potential power that they have together, then the pressure from above, more often than not, outweighs the pressure from below. And the fourth connection is the background of Labor politicians. Early on, Labor politicians were very largely working class men rather than women, but they were people who had grown up as workers and had worked for a boss and then had got jobs in trade unions and then went on to positions in Parliament. Today, there are still large numbers of parliamentarians with union backgrounds, although they have less frequently been workers than before. And here the special guest appearance is evidence of that being the case. Bill has not been a rank and file worker. His route to the top of the AWU, where he was the National Secretary, was not by virtue of his skill with shearing sheep. Okay, so these connections still exist, and they were there at the beginning of the Labor Party. But those connections have been attenuated, which is a fancy way of saying they've become much thinner, over more than a century of the Labor Party's existence. On the other hand, the party has become more and more tightly integrated with capitalism by virtue of its extensive experience in office, its closer relationships with top layers of the state machine and the capitalist class, many of whom no longer as their forefathers, not mothers, their forefathers at the top of the bureaucracy, the public service bureaucracy and the police and the judiciary and the armed forces, who regarded the Labor Party with disdain as an organisation of inferior upstarts. So, on the one hand, thinner connections with the working class, on the other hand, closer relationships with the capitalist class and also with those members of the capitalist class who staff the upper echelons of the state machine. Not profit-making capitalists, but people who supervise the work of those people in the bureaucracies below them. There's also been, over time, a shift away from the funding of its activities by trade union affiliation fees and donations from working people towards a reliance on public funding, that is, the state funding political parties, including the Labor Party. Nevertheless, the capitalist class is still much closer to and more integrated with its preferred party. And just sort of working out. Thank you. I've gone for 25 minutes already. God, I go on at the mouth. In terms of connections with those four kinds of connections with the working class, in terms of membership, well, the Labor Party's membership has been dramatically hollowed out, has become less and less blue-collar, but is still somewhat more proletarian than that of the membership of the Liberal Party or, for that matter, of the Greens. But the mainstream, the big political parties, the Labor Party, the Liberal Party and the Nationals, their memberships have been hollowed out. They're pretty small compared to the past. The Labor Party, for the last decade or so, has been claiming to have 40,000 members, but the number of members who actually vote in internal elections for the party's leadership of the party machine is much, much less than that. It's around half or less than that. In terms of voters, well, the commitment of working people to the Labor Party has declined on average, but as I said, it's still much more pronounced than that of either the Conservative parties or the Greens. The weight of union officials in the party compared with its major other major component, two fundamental components of the Labor Party, the union officials and the parliamentarians. Well, there's been a decline of trade union membership and militancy, and this has signalled a shift in the balance between the party's main components towards the politicians and away from the union officials having a big say by virtue of unions being represented at the state conferences of the party. That's not to say they don't have any weight. They do. They still have a very significant weight. And what's more, because of the hollowing out of the Labor Party's membership, the Labor Party is now more reliant on the trade unions for feet on the ground. Anybody who has signed up to any change the rules type thing will have got incessant emails and even text messages and robocalls from the ACTU or Trades Hall Council or the ACT, Unions ACT in Canberra, where I'm from, asking people to donate money and also to put in Labor with a small L and a U to try and get the Labor Party elected through phone banking or door knocking. So the trade unions play an important role in that respect. In terms of the background of Labor politicians, as I said, there are still quite a few who have union backgrounds, but many fewer who have actually been rank and file workers and union members. So for these reasons, and because the Labor Party's pitch is much more to its working class base, voting for the Labor Party still involves, in quite a lot of cases, some level, a low level, of class consciousness. Now, I think I'm going to have to skip very rapidly through the history of the Labor Party. I want to skip through the first 50 years to what is sometimes talked about as a golden age under John Curtin and Ben Chifley, who led the Labor Party during and after the Second World War up to 1949. And that was a period in which Labor sent off Australian workers to kill workers from other countries in an imperialist war, in which Labor cut working class living standards by freezing wages and allowing a cost-plus basis for business that supplied the war effort, and also introduced for the first time the taxation of workers' incomes, income tax levied on workers at the federal level. And in return for that, there was the implementation of a more generous and extensive welfare state. But that welfare state was funded by workers through the introduction of income tax on them. The Chifley government, after Curtin had died, maintained the wage freeze after the war, which led to a massive strike wave, which broke the wage freeze. The Chifley government set up that friend of minority groups, Muslims, workers, leftists, ASIO, as part of its anti-communist efforts. The introduction of a more extensive welfare state certainly benefited workers. It also made for a more reliable working class. That is, if you've got reasonably skilled labour, you don't want them being off crook. You want workers to be better educated so they could can do their jobs. The other golden age that's still referred to, and this is in some respects a bit bizarre, is the Whitlam period. Now, in part, this is because Whitlam came into office in 1972 after a prolonged period of conservative government and set about renovating Australian capitalism along lines that was intended to benefit Australian capital. And at the same time, because when Whitlam came to power, the global economy was still in boom, and that included the Australian economy, involved certain benefits for the Australian working class as well. So free education, which I benefited from, but many of you didn't, because Labor introduced it and Labor took it away again later on. Also the introduction of what was originally called Medibank, it's now Medicare, important gains for working people. But the first neoliberal budget in Australia was in response to the end of the long post-war boom, which occurred during the period of the Whitlam government, whose whole strategy, its economic and welfare strategy, was premised on the idea that the boom would continue. Sadly, they weren't aware of the Marxist analyses of the inherent crisis nature of capitalism. The boom stopped, and the first neoliberal budget was the 1975 budget, introduced by a guy who later on got around with a top hat on as Governor General, a guy called Bill Hayden. That's a skip through history. If you want more history, we can discuss that later. What will Labor do in office? Well, formal policies, such as I went through earlier on, only tell us a limited amount about what a shortened government will actually do. We know that it will be committed to managing, promoting and defending Australian capitalism at home and abroad. It makes no secret that that is its agenda. It's just it's in favour of a nicer capitalism. If there is an upsurge of militancy amongst workers, Labor will attempt to curb it and will be better placed to do so in many respects through co-optation than the Conservatives would be. And you know, that was what the Accord was all about, the co-optation of the union leaderships into the program of assisting Australian capitalism to deal with the end of the long boom. And I suppose some of you went to the forum that was on the Prices and Incomes Accord that was yesterday. Labor can be more effective in heading off militancy precisely because of its connections with the working class. In the face of a severe recession, Labor will be prepared to attack working class living standards head on to maintain profit rates. The Syriza government that came to office in Greece in 2015, whenever, had a vastly more left-wing program than that of the Labor Party today. Much more left-wing. And what's more, it came into office after a period of significant industrial action by Greek workers against cutbacks implemented by New Democracy Conservative Party. But when it came to the crunch, Syriza introduced neoliberal policies and is still introducing appalling neoliberal policies in Greece, which have impoverished the Greek working class and even more so those dependent on social security payments. The prospects that Australia will avoid a recession as it did during the global financial crisis, largely thanks to continued growth in China, you know, obviously due to Labor Party policies. Very clever to have iron ore put in the ground in Western Australia and then export it to China. Stunning policy. The prospects that Australia will be able to avoid the next severe economic downturn are pretty limited. Furthermore, if the United States calls on the Labor government to support military intervention, then it is likely to do so. Not only in rhetoric, but at least also allowing US intelligence facilities in Australia to play a role in US military intervention. So US spy bases in Australia play an important role in monitoring communications around the world, accurate targeting of missiles, and so on. And it is virtually certain that the Labor government will not want to jeopardise the US alliance by saying anything that undermines those installations. In other terms, Tanya Plibersek has already declared, the deputy leader of the Labor Party, supposedly a key figure in the left, has declared that she is prepared to take on teachers' unions over the introduction of incentive pay in schools. The government of that well-known Bolshevik, Daniel Andrews, has announced recently that the days of generous agreements over pay and conditions for public sector workers in Australia are over. Now, it's all fine. I had some slides and some more music, but never mind that. In conclusion, Labor is every bit as much of a threat to the working class as the coalition. But it damages working class interests in a distinctive way by virtue of its more intimate connection with the working class rather than being the ruling class's favourite lover, which is the coalition. Labor is a shorten-headed boa constrictor which seeks to sensuously embrace the working class while pointing at the tiger. There would have been a tiger up there. Which is the coalition government. And that embrace can be every bit as damaging for the working class as the claws and the teeth of that tiger.